Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia here on a Sunday morning. We'll begin with a reading of the Declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So welcome to a Sunday morning here at the Lodge in Philadelphia. Each Sunday, beginning at 11, we have our meeting during the during July and September. We're studying the epitome of theosophy, which is an assimilation, a condensation of the entire philosophy written by one of the co-founders, Mr. Judge. And this evening, or this morning, we are studying the part on universal evolution that begins on page 11. Our meeting goes from 11 to 12. The doors open at 10:30 sharp. On Wednesdays during the summer, just bear in mind, July and September on Sundays, but August Sundays, we don't have meetings. On Wednesdays during the summertime, we have meetings on the Bhagavad Gita. We're currently studying the Bhagavad Gita, which is a world-renowned treatise on ethics from ancient Hinduism. And that study class is Wednesday evenings from 7:30 to 8:30, which is a short reading and then plenty of room for talk and discussion and questions through the hour. Of course, on Wednesday afternoon, the lodge opens at 5:15. We have a reference library that's available to the public. All the meetings are open to everybody, to the public, for free. And you're certainly welcome to come to this reference library. There's always somebody there who can answer questions or direct you in whatever line of theosophical pursuit you may be currently in. Right, and so that's every Wednesday through the summer. So the lodge here in Philadelphia and everywhere in the world, any United Lodge of Theosophists, is open to the public for free. There's no costs or fees or dues that are associated with attending the meetings. Our purpose is to hold the fundamental teachings of the ancient wisdom religion before the public. Before all those who we feel it is the birthright to learn, and we make it available as we see fit. That being said, all the work that's done here is done by voluntary contributions of time, money, and effort. No one here is paid 5 cents to do anything, speakers or otherwise, that has to do with theosophical work. Any contributions are certainly gratefully received. So we begin this morning with the topic is universal evolution, starts on page 11 in the Epitome of Theosophy. We know some people have the handout, so to prevent confusion, when we have questions, because the pages don't correspond, just mention if it's toward the beginning, the middle, or the end of the part, and maybe mention the first couple words of the paragraph so we can all get on track when the question is raised. That being said, we'll have a summary of the part taken, or given, thank you.
So as was said, we're going to be looking at universal evolution, and we just wanted to mention that the part from last week actually was talking about the first fundamental, which was deity. And when we're looking at evolution, we're also bringing in the idea of that deific essence, because manifestation proceeds from it. It does not manifest, but manifestation proceeds from it. And then we're looking at physical manifestation and evolution. So we start off by looking at this idea of spirit, or purusha, and it proceeds from Brahma, which is that idea of the impersonal, what they call para-Brahma. And it says that it proceeds from Brahma through various forms at the same time. So it begins in the world of spirit, which is the highest, and then proceeds down lower to the lowest form, which is the material world. So when we're looking at the material world of mineral, vegetable, and animal forms, these forms imprison the spark of the divine. And then this is what evolution basically is. And it says at the bottom here that the spark struggles to return to the Father, or in other words, to achieve self-consciousness. And man is the highest form of self-consciousness. And then, as we'll see, there are different levels of self-consciousness that man also goes through. And this spark of divinity, the process it goes through to become self-conscious, takes millions of ages to accomplish this. And just because it is in the physical human form, does not confer self-consciousness upon this divine spark. So the divine spark reaches human form, or it may not, he says, but it all depends on the individual and his choices and his efforts. And even the Mahatmas and the Rishis are also gradually evolving during the life period, also called a Manvantara, and they eventually will become these planetary spirits that guide the evolutions of all the future planets. And they have these efforts as well. They have to keep working and choosing and making right choices, just as we do at our level. So these Mahatmas then will probably be the planetary spirits of the next great period of evolution, or the Manvantara. And this system is the idea that is based upon this wonderful theosophical idea that has been handed down through the ages of universal brotherhood. The sages say that this Purusha is the basis of all manifested objects, and it interpenetrates everything. Everything is in it, and it is within everything. And this is what connects us all together. And again, this is the idea of universal brotherhood. And when we're looking at this idea of spirit and matter, or as they're putting here, intellect, it says that there is a level below spirit and above intellect, another plane of consciousness which absorbs all the experiences, and it is commonly known as man's spiritual nature. The upper level registers all sensations and experiences, and it is also sometimes called the subconscious mind. Theosophy states that there is a misuse of terms to say that the spiritual nature can be cultivated, because the spiritual nature is, just is. The real object to be kept in view is that we should make our minds porous to this spiritual nature so that it can come through. But the spiritual nature is not cultivated. It is actually coming through and cultivating the mind, the nature of the person. So the real man, who is considered to be the higher self and is also the spark of the divine that we have been discussing, overshadows the physical form, but it still has the opportunity to become united with that spark of the divine. The spiritual culture is only attainable if we are able to rid ourselves or to raise up the grosser interests, passions, and demands of the flesh. And the spirit can only become the ruler when the intellectual acknowledgement or admission is first made that it, in capitals, alone is. So we have to be able to raise up all our lower passions and desires, and if there's even the smallest remnant of that selfishness, then that divine state will be more difficult to attain. So lastly, there is a spiritual training, so to speak, that we are all going through, that we have to get our lower nature under control. And it says that the spiritual training, which is to acquire perception of and control over the various forces of nature, and as well as getting our nature under control, we also have to gain the knowledge of natural law. And by gaining this idea of natural law, that will also help us onto our spiritual goal.
So there's a lot there to consider. Any contributions or questions along the way? Yes.
The concept of spark. Could you address that and
So this concept of spark, as in the spark of the divine, where is that coming from, and how many are there, and where does it come from? Well, let's release our mind of the concept of quantity and distance, and just look to qualities and proportion. The idea that our universe conceptually can be seen as, or can be envisioned as, a point in the middle of a circle, but we're told that really the point, which in geometry class we learn doesn't even really exist because it has no dimensions, yet theosophy would ask us to imagine that the point is everywhere and the circumference is nowhere. So deity is ever present, and the divine spark in deity, then there's the tendency to say, well, we each have a divine spark of deity, and this is true, but it's not true in any measure that we're less than deity itself, and that's the challenge, because our responsibility to the universe is to participate in the plan that's laid out by what? Cosmic mind, according to cosmic law. And we all have that duty to participate. We all have that opportunity to participate. So whereas we all are a spark of deity, that helps us conceive of that, yet we also are, if we choose to be, we can fully participate in the plan of deity. The acorn does fully participate in the plan of deity to the degree that it is designed to, and it can, and it doesn't have a choice, and it's perfect. The question is, does the human being fully participate in the universal plan? And the answer is, well, how are we doing? Do we have a knowledge of who we are, and do we know the purpose and plan for our lives? And that's all along the lines of choice and will, sacrifice, and releasing our personal desires. There was a hand here.
The speaker mentioned natural law. I just wondered what's meant by natural law.
So the question has to do with, what is natural law? Well, in certainly in theosophy, we make the point to bring up the idea that there's no personal God that dictates who's right, who's wrong, what's wrong, as a matter of his or her personal desires. So we're going to leave the idea of a deific being out of it. That's not to say that the presence of the divine is not everywhere. So then where does this natural law come from? Well, in theosophy, the word, when we consider what is nature, nature is the interaction and the interrelation of all forms of consciousness, from the most inconceivably unnoticeable to the fullest archangels or Dion Shohans, and the interaction of all these consciousness. The interaction of these different levels of consciousness in harmony is, and this is certainly a subject to research, is what we would say is the law. And so it's our duty to participate that in the truth of that and discover that for ourselves, really. And at the human level, it really all begins with, you know, what do we see? What is our basis for thought? What is our religious inclination? Yes, and then I know your hands are, yes.
Thus, therefore, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal forms, each imprisoned a spark of the divine, a portion of the invisible purusha. I think that's technically, when this was all put down, as of today, I think just in certain fields of science, they would agree with this.
that the spark of the divine is ever present. And so that spark of the divine, if we're talking about the divine, we can speak of the divine as a principle, and we can speak of the divine as the divine law. And we can see if the divine law is universal, then it is in operation on all planes, in common with all beings. And the word mutatis mutandis is used according to the conditions of the situation. Well, there are certain things that all forms of life have, such as growth, you know, and we could go into that. And so if science were willing to admit that there's something divine about that, modern day materialistic science, then sure. And whether or not it officially does, we couldn't speak to, we're not a scientist. Yes?
Well, on that question, science is beginning to recognize the intelligence in the vegetable kingdom, which is a big step for science. But as long as they think that the mind is the molecules moving in the brain, they're far from a realization. In your very first comment, it was very well put, but one of the things that gets left out is people making a judgment about other people, like, I see and recognize the divine, therefore I'm going somewhere in that direction. But look at that poor person. He's homeless, or he's a miser, or he's in prison. And we make a judgment about them. Whereas Theosophy says, for all we know, that condition might be the last thing they have to get rid of before they step forward on the highest level of the path. So we cannot even look at ourselves, let alone anyone else, and make a judgment.
Thank you. So the contribution has to do with about judgment, and probably if we all accept that when we look out into the world around us, remember there's inductive thinking, there's deductive thinking, but the philosopher is an inductive thinker, which is to say, he recognizes that the world around me is a reflection of the world within me. What did Gandhi say? If you want to change the world, change yourself. So if we find ourselves in judgment of something or someone, thank them for it, because it's an opportunity to go within and figure out what adjustments or improvements need to be made. Thank you. Yes?
Yes, hi. This concept of the divine spark, this divine spark come from the source, the creator, or creator's creator, the source. I'm going to stick with this particular source. And did it happen during the process of creation or during the fall of man? The divine spark is, from what I have learned, is in everything seen and unseen. I've heard it was through this so-called theory of the Big Bang. Through the Big Bang, it released all this divine essence that came into creation. I'm still trying to get my mind down. Where did it come from? And really, what does it penetrate?
Okay, so let's revisit the divine spark. What's the source of it? Where's it coming from? And mention was made of the Big Bang. There are theories of creation. There are really every religion and really mythology typically is a story, has cosmology in it. And we're going to take a minute and just put the Big Bang theory to the side, because that is a theory for purely materialistic thinking. So, what's the source of this spark? What is it? Back to the idea of law. Law is eternal. And the manifestation of the unknowable, ever undefinable, unrecognizable divine The manifestation of it is a coming forth of it. We talk about Brahma. And then the withdrawal of it, we talk about Shiva. So there's this ever cyclic process. And then there's the night where there is no manifestation, and then another cycle. So we bring that up because manifestation comes along according to law, which simply is. It's the interrelationship of all consciousness. So there's no creator. So it was interesting that the questioner said, you know, well, we don't want to say creator, we'll just stick with the source. There is no creator. There is creation as in manifestation, but not creation out of nothing. Everything starts, as the part says, with prakriti and purusha. Maybe you can think of the as an analogy, not as a specific answer to it, but this prakriti and purusha, sometimes spirit matter is helpful to think of it, sometimes even yin and yang as an analogy, sometimes the negative and positive forces of just this cosmic electricity, which yet has no pole because nothing exists. There's just this yin and yang, okay? So where's the spark coming from? Evolution in theosophy, it's helpful to realize that evolution, it's the doctrine of emanation is behind evolution. And emanation simply is a coming forth into existence of that which was in the past and will be in the future according to law. So the forms that we see were not created by a god, but rather are the results, are the effects of past causes. And the sparks, at the spark of the divine, which all is, in the beginning of manifestation, each individual, each spark takes up a journey, an obligatory pilgrimage to experience everything that there is to experience in the universe on every plane during that period of evolution. And it goes through all of the lower kingdoms up to the point of man according to natural impulse, according to natural law. But that's where natural law stops, is at the level of man. At the level of the human being, we continue to evolve according to self-induced means, which means figure it out, it's within you, pull it together. And self-devised methods. Now that you've figured it out, that you have it, how are you going
to
use it?
You know, spark.
The spark. Yes, the spark, once at the level of human consciousness, continues to evolve and to cause evolution, only according to self-induced means and self-devised methods. The purpose of it is to fully come into the universal wisdom, to fully, so that spirit can fully know itself. That's the purpose of the universe. That spirit fully knows itself, can reflect on itself during this period of Manvantara, and that more human minds come to a full absolute knowledge and participation in that. It's there. Go to the library and think of it.
We might ask ourselves, where did my sense of I come from? And the more you ask yourself that question, the more you realize you can't answer it because you are the answer. You are that I am no other. And you'll never know where it came from. If you think about it too long, you'll lie in a stupor for a week because nothing makes sense except there is that sense of I. And then ask yourself, well, where do my thoughts come from? Where do my opinions come from? And you begin to realize you are your own force in the universe. And you create. But you create because you are that I, which is universal. It's too mysterious to put into words.
It's too mysterious, but thank you for bringing it down. Because, you know, when we talk about these things, you know, starting on universal with universal ideas is very important because that's the plane where we are all, our true identity is. That's our source. It's the source. But to make it practical, to accept that if there's universal law, universal means universal, start on the plane of universal, so it applies on every plane. So if I'm not participating, well, let's look at it this way. If things aren't going that well, could it be that I'm not participating in the universal law as the plan would be unfolding before me? And if I'm not, whose fault is it? Right? Well, whatever the answer is to that question, whatever the answer is to that question, the responsibility is mine. Because if I'm experiencing karma, then I can only experience that karma if I created it and or participated in the creation of it and or was irresponsible and didn't do something to and caused the creation of it, you know? So it's all about the individual. How do we participate in the law as we understand it? And it's all about, you know, learning all of, how do I live my life is all about motive, but it's all about common sense. It's about rejecting false ideas as we learn that they're false, and finding how to replace them. And, you know, and so the start is accept the one main principle that universal brotherhood is the fact, it's the basis from which we are and think and operate. I mean, that's in the idea. If we're not, then all of these conflicts arise, yes.
But it's leaving out the individual. Someone like Martin Luther King, he knew he was going to die, and that did not stop him, that did not prevent him. He must have taken some sort of vow or promise to live to the highest. So it wasn't negative karma acting on him, it was his choice to act from the highest no matter what conditions. So we have to remember, and we think it's especially important for ourselves, or you look at someone like HPB, she suffered physically in order to bring all of this to us, but it never stopped her, it never made her pause. We think it made her work harder and faster.
So along this line, when we're talking about situations where people willfully accept, recognize that things are going to be tough, that's not because they're doing the wrong thing necessarily. It's because they're taking the road less traveled. And, you know, most of the people in the world, everybody in the world does it to a degree. And a useful example of that is every parent knows when they make the decision that they're going to have troubles, or no, that they're going to have children, they're going to have trouble. So there you go. Enough said. Please.
Okay. To reach the level of the highest divinity that man can reach, like a Mahat.
Sure.
You know, we're not gonna get it all in just one lifetime. I mean, that's a profound act performed. Like you said, it was individual. The individual has to come to know these things, grow. So let's say a person
has to come to know these names.
Madam just spoke about a person who was is stricken with polish, and you know they have a divine spark as well.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
And so they are at the level of knowledge, and they're placed in the universe as they are. But let's say they pass on,
right,
and never reach that level in this life.
Right.
Do they reincarnate to continue that journey to reach that highest evolution of the stage of man in which they're supposed to attain? Like a Mahat.
Right.
Ascended master.
So then the question is, you know, can it be done in one lifetime of 80 years? And really, our understanding is the answer is no. Which is the basis. I mean, the reason why human beings reincarnate is because of, actually, it's grounded in our desires and to fulfill the universal purpose. So if the universal purpose is that we come to full understanding and full wisdom as is the highest possible by the human being in this period of evolution, it takes many, many lifetimes. Many, many lifetimes. So the steps in that direction, you know, for kindergartners, it doesn't take too long for the kindergartner to know that the more, or any young child, the more you try often, the more attention you get from your teacher, so she or he can make sure that you're still challenged, you know? Whereas others may not be trying as hard or may be getting stuck in certain other areas, and the teachers handle that different ways. But along the lines, when we talk about spiritual culture or spiritual cultivation, we're not talking about cultivating or evolving our spirit per se. We're talking about creating the conditions within our being so that spirit can more completely manifest through it. And so that's what we need to do, is work with everything that's not spirit so that we can be the best temple for spirit that we can be. And that's all about, okay, taking the steps in that direction. And while it is an individual decision and an individual effort, that's not to say that when we're on the path, it's not to say that there isn't assistance that's made available from the highest part of the divine when we find ourselves moving in the way that's right for the individual, right? So you can't get it from another person per se. The help comes from inner planes. So we'll go there. Yes?
Yet another person can provoke you, either by upsetting you or loaning you a book, and you suddenly realize you've been waiting for that book your entire life, or by just saying something that's shocking to you. We know when we first came here, we thought, no, we could never do this. And we discussed this with an older student, and he shook his head and said, you know, you're not the world's greatest sinner either.
Thank you. We appreciate the contribution. Yes?
In our youth, we remember the comic strips on Sunday. One that we always loved to read, or had read to us, rather, was Flash Gordon. When we consider in our modern society the fragmented teachings as they have been taken, twisted, turned around, and so forth. And we come to these rooms, and the first thing we start out with is a discussion, such as this, the epitome, and so forth. We begin to see that everything is fragmented. We have to stop and think. We have to concentrate. And then the term meditation comes in. Could you tell us, just basically, how did we begin that process of meditation in order to really get a better understanding what's given out?
So the question here has to do with, a lot of times we look out into the world, we see this fragmented, this bunch of parts that seem not to be moving in harmony, and we hear that meditation helps. Where do you start? How do you do it, all this? Well, for sure, the individual effort that's made in the direction to meditate has to be discovered by the person. So we don't come to theosophy and teach meditation. Yet the philosophy encourages all students to discover it for oneself. Mr. Judge has written a lot on it. And meditation is a process of calming the lower self, like a placid lake. Meditation is the opportunity to not be distracted by that and to turn to the higher. It's an opportunity to reflect on our values and watch how our priorities change as we continue to meditate. The very act of meditating is an act that causes distractions to evolve in our brains just by trying to clear out things. That makes more room for it. So it requires concentration and will. And when we use the word concentration, we're talking about focused attention on the act of meditation, and to consciously, actively consider, you know, universal ideas, whether it's gratitude, whether it's evolution or something, but not to blank our minds. That is an unhealthy practice. So the invitation is read about it, learn about it, practice it, and decide for oneself the direction that one takes meditation in. And the last thing would be is, if you're going to do it, needs to be consistent every day. Yes.
The sages say that this Purusha, and the bottom, the last sentence, which is long, it says, "For below the spirit and above the intellect is a plane of consciousness in which experiences are noted, commonly called man's spiritual nature." Is that Bodhi?
We would agree. We're still looking for that sentence. It's on page 13, the bottom
paragraph.
The top paragraph, last sentence, right. So, but below the spirit, Atman, above mind is that part of us which is Buddhi, which is, so if we corresponded to the universals, Atman corresponds to the unknowable. Buddhi corresponds to that first differentiation, which is the what's known as the logos, in which the plan for the universe is during that period of manifestation. And so that principle within every human being is if we reach up toward it, which if one is able to accomplish that for a flash of a second in a lifetime, it's quite an inspiration. That's the full participation in universal. We can't say, I have my Buddhi. We could say, I have my fingernails, but we can't say, I have my Buddhi, because really, Buddhi is a universal principle from which we are suspended. Yes? To answer the question, what is Buddhi? It's helpful to consider the idea of Buddhi corresponds in the Christian theology to the Holy Spirit, except it's not a person. It is the source of wisdom. It is the source of truth. It is, as we participate in Buddhi, we become more fully human. Okay? But it's not a person. It's a universal principle. Please.
We think everybody can say they have experienced that. What is love? What is gratitude? What is appreciation? What is empathy? Those things are not physical, and they are part of that spiritual nature. And even if we're a selfish, mean, and ugly person, we probably have some of those feelings for those who are close to us. So everybody, I think, has touched that, tasted that.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes?
On the top of page 12 in the pamphlet, where it says the period calculated in human time during which this evolution goes on embraces millions of ages. Each spark of divinity has therefore millions of ages in which to complete, and here's the question, self-consciousness while in the form of man. This idea of self-consciousness, when you read that,
So what is Mr. Judge talking about when he's mentioning self-consciousness? Because he even goes to say that there you know, there's a point during evolution where you may be a human being, but you're not necessarily self-conscious. Very interesting. So all right, then when we use the term self-consciousness, what are we talking about? Well, consciousness is awareness, it's knowing. Dogs are conscious. When a dog's hungry, he eats. But a human is self-conscious. Most of us, right? When he's hungry, he makes a decision whether or not it's the right stuff to eat, whether it's time to eat, whether it's healthy enough food. He may or may not eat. So he's not going to follow the impulse. The lower kingdoms don't have the option to not follow the impulse. They follow the impulse. So, yet, this idea, and so this faculty of self-consciousness, if we recognize it in ourselves and use it, is that faculty of being able to see that, I'm in the middle of this with these people, and rather than reacting, I'm going to sit back and decide first what my response is going to be, being self-conscious. The faculty of self-consciousness gives us the ability to reflect on our day, and by reflecting on our day and seeing how we react and deciding whether it was in the highest interest, not judging. If we judge, we blow it. Don't judge, just observe it. That is the use of self-consciousness, and we grow in wisdom from that. A human being can grow in wisdom just by remembering certain circumstances. Even if we end up in jail because of it, we can grow in wisdom from it, right? So apparently, the question then here is, self-consciousness is it's a big deal, a lot more than that. Well, if there are aspects of us that we read about but haven't necessarily yet learned about because we don't feel it, see it, touch it, use it, we don't know that much about it, then we're not very conscious of it. So there's a lot of powers within the human being, such as willpower, that often when we act, we are not conscious of. And if we were more conscious of it, then some of our actions wouldn't be, some of the words we say probably would be different if we were more self-conscious, right? So full self-consciousness of the Mahatma is a complete knowledge of every principle within him, psychologically, emotionally, the willpower, physically, intellectually, complete knowledge, complete consciousness of everything, and a knowledge and control of the lower potencies around him to the degree that he knows everything that he does, what the effect it's going to be on everything around him. Which is why also an adept who's on his way to Mahatmaship, a highly evolved human being who's not yet a Mahatma, it is said an adept never acts unless he can see the consequence of that act in the mind of another adept, and then decide if it's the right action. Very interesting. Check, test, verify the steps we take. Yeah?
Well, we've always been amazed at the language used. On one page, in other words, the last page, Robert says, when systematically trained, men attain to clear insight.
Yeah, which power? No, we need the first. Wait, what's the page?
Yeah, towards the end.
Okay. Page 14. Okay. Okay.
When systematically trained, in accord with their court system, it's based further on, they are able, certain stages are able to look directly upon ideas. They look directly upon ideas. Well, that sounds like some of us sometimes when we hear something and say, oh, I see what you mean. We never think about the words we use. And if we did, we'd grasp these. each one of us, by grasping these ideas, may be in a position to apply and are able to look directly at one idea. And so their testimony is as trustworthy as is that of scientists or philosophers to truth in their respective fields.
Okay, so this contribution / question has to do, it brings us back to meditation, and it has to do with self-induced methods. You know, a lot of people are, so here, let's look at it this way. There are folks who think, well, gee whiz, if I do this, I wonder, you know, am I going to spiritually grow, and am I going to get more psychically aware, and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, and when does the training start? And like, can I sign up for this? Well, if we are lit up already, we have self-conscious minds, even if we're dimly lit, it's our responsibility to shine brighter. And we need to do what we need to do, you know, to the wax of the candle so that the light is brighter, right? So until we have done what we need to do to get on the track, at least, to have the highest quality wax, why would we seek training from, so you know, the question is, we already have faculties within us that we probably don't use to the fullest of our understanding and capacity, or that we may be using in kind of selfish ways. And if we just change our thinking and live our lives a certain way, then these faculties naturally are going to affect the world around us in more positive ways. So when Mr. Judge talks about when systematically trained in accordance to the aforesaid system and law, well, we all have it, and that system needs to be a system that the individual puts in place for himself. When you've gotten as good as you can get, ethically and morally, first and foremost, then perhaps you're ready and the teacher will appear, right? So that's first. But then second, he talks about this idea of looking directly upon ideas. And, trustworthy with testimony, trustworthy as the scientist or the philosopher as to the truth. Well, that's, you know, if we physically work out, then we get stronger and we know we can lift that chair. We could probably lift 5 of those chairs. I don't know if we could lift 10 of those chairs. If we study math, we can know when we read a math problem, if we've been studying, we can know when we read that math problem whether I could probably work this out or not, because I know the principles of mathematics. If I really study math a lot and get a real hard problem, I'll probably even recognize what I can't do, right? Well, those are the muscles that are developed when we study math. When we meditate, what muscles are developed when we meditate? The muscles that are developed when we meditate are the muscles that give us the ability to hear an idea and know it, whether it's true or not, without figuring out, arguing it, reasoning it, any of that kind of stuff, the ability to hear it, and this idea of looking upon the ideas. We're not talking about being metaphysical and seeing into the invisible, but just hearing it and knowing it. But not condemn it, because who's to say? Who's perfect? So test it if there's value to it. Yes, there's a hand.
Well, we hear a lot of people say, well, I heard you, but I don't see it.
I hear what you're saying, but I have no idea what you're talking about. Sure. Sure, yeah, right. And it could be simply, you know, two people can say the exact same sentence, and the meaning of the sentence is completely different if it's a teacher telling a student or a mother telling a daughter. Two complete, but the same words. So the ideas, the, you know, words, what we put into the words, the ideas and the emotion that we put in words, words are birds. They bring the ideas to the other person. And it's for us not to code it with what we're all about, but to use compassion, empathy, and understanding what's this other person trying to convey, you know, and there's as much psychic faculties involved in doing that as in anything else. Yes.
It's also the person receiving the statement. You can take a statement from a teacher or someone you look up to, but heaven help the person in your family who says it to you. because then it hurts and you don't want to hear it. So it isn't always what someone says, it's who's saying it.
Thank you.
Love conquers all. Love over will.
Love conquers all. Love over will. Compassion is the law of laws. It's not an emotion. It's a power of the soul. You can decide to love the other. That's what compassion is. All right. You know what happens when this happens. I have questions for you. There's a portion that we highlighted. What is being said when the spirit can only become the ruler when the firm intellectual acknowledgement or admission is made first, or admission is first made that it alone is? What's being suggested here is that the person has to acknowledge that I don't even exist. Spirit is, I'm not. What's behind that? Why is that? What's going on there?
But you said person.
Right.
It's the individual. The individual I is the reincarnating spiritual being. And I am reading those ideas. If I think I am the power, I'm wrong. If I recognize that divinity is in everyone and everything, then I'm moving in the right direction. So it isn't that I don't exist, it's that my importance doesn't exist. There is something higher.
And so then it's not that I don't exist, it's just that there's something higher. And we think that the idea of self-induced means and self-devised methods in this spiritual cultivation is the process by which we as personalities who thinking I am a man of this age and this country and this, all these qualifications and identifications, the sooner we can release that and simply accept the I aspect of it is the sooner, you know, is the sooner that we release trying to peg other people and put them in their little categories and stack rank what we think is right about people or wrong about people. So we have to get to the I aspect of it. And so he's saying then, with a firm intellectual acknowledgement or admission is first made that it alone is. So we often talk about identifying with someone. We identify as a this. I identify as a that. We have to release that and realize the only thing I really am is a thinker using this stuff. What am I doing with this stuff? Well, if I'm raised to, in certain isms, then there's a lot of work to be done to climb out of that way of thinking and into a place where we can see that, you know, it's, you know, namaste, the he in me greets the he in thee, and we're both the same he that we're saying hi to, right? Yeah.
Well, I have to think about that because you're just saying ideas rule the world.
Ideas rule the world. That's a great idea, and let it rule our world for the next week because our meeting's over. So we have another meeting on Wednesday evening. Starts at 7:30.